Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And thank you for joining us again today for another edition of Midrats. And for those that are with the Exalted Group who are joining us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you'll find the chat room. If you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, or if there are some questions you would like to have us direct to our guests, that's a great place to do it. We'll be haunting it during the course of the show, and we'll be more than happy to steal your great ideas and bring them in. And if you have to run off and take care of some stuff, like you've got a hurricane coming down and you have to take care of trees in the backyard, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio later, or just take the shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes. But until then, let's go ahead and get on with the show. And in an era of a 24-hour news cycle where subject matter accuracy and knowledge, what you're talking about, is absolutely essential to report, not just be early, but to be the most accurate. It's been a very, very challenging year for those in the military media, especially the Navy-focused media, because of all the events that have happened outside of the long war and all of our combat operations we're doing. And what we wanted to do today is to talk about the business and the art of doing that in such a fast-changing environment. And for the professional journalists, those who do this for a living and everybody else relies on, the last few months have really shown and reminded everybody that the peacetime naval operations, things can happen that have long-term consequences. And many times, as you examine why they've happened and how they've happened, if you just keep pulling that thread and more things come up and one story leads to another. And when done right, it not only informs the public, but in many ways can help the service better improve itself in the futures. And it gets real serious when we've seen recently just between the USS Fitzgerald and USS John S. McCain, 17 sailors have died in peace. And telling that story, it's serious. It affects a lot of people. But if it's done right, there's a lot of good that you can salvage from such events, from the SECNAV on down, and the decisions that are made to hopefully take something of value into the future. And we're real happy with the guest that we have for the full hour coming back to Midrats to discuss this. And that's going to be David Larter. He is the Naval Warfare Reporter for Defense News. He's a graduate of the University of Richmond. He's also a former Operations Specialist Second Class. And I'll see if I can get hold of this PQS book sometime down the road to make sure that everything's in order. But until then, reporting from a major transportation hub on the East Coast, David, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you for having me, Sal. I really do appreciate it.
Hey, we kind of hinted here that you're sitting in the airport about to head off to places east of that wild and exciting and sexy life of the military-focused journalist. If you wanted to, just take a second to tell the listener, first of all, if you're wearing a trench coat, a vest, or any 511 tactical gear while waiting to get on the airplane, but where are you going and what you're going to be doing for the next week?
So my assignment is to head over to London to go to see DSEI, and don't tell – I mean, I suffer from that old military disease of speaking in acronyms that I don't understand, so I can't tell you exactly what that stands for. But it is a big defense show, one of the biggest in the world. It takes place in London every year – or every other year? No, every year. And I am not wearing anything exciting, just slacks and a sport coat because I got to get off the plane at 7:55 in the morning, London time, and then go straight to work, which should be just about as awesome as that sounds.
I think Sal hit on it. We've had a couple of, mm-hmm. of major accidents with the destroyers or guided missile destroyers getting hit by merchant ships. In your view, is this a unique situation? Because why are we getting so much news coverage on this? Is it because we have so few ships and so many sailors died, or what?
So it's interesting. I think there's a number of elements that play into the media coverage. I will tell you that when the Fitzgerald happened, there was international interest. There was media interest. I got calls from CNN International and Sky News and a few other places to go on and talk a little bit about the accident. But nowhere near the level of interest that I saw when the McCain collision happened. When the McCain collision happened, I was having dinner with my girlfriend at an Italian restaurant on Southwest Waterfront, and the waiter was coming over to ask if I wanted a second glass of wine. And that's when my colleague at Marine Corps Times, Jeff Schogel, texted me and said, "Hey, it happened again. John S. McCain involved in the collision." And it was kind of surreal and it was unbelievable. And that, the fact that it happened within 65 days of the last time that this had happened, I think it caught everybody by surprise. And I think people made a logical assumption that something was rotten in the state of Denmark out there. The general reader, Joe Sixpack, CNN viewer. I don't know if Joe Sixpack watches CNN or what, but their first question is, how does this advanced warship with all these radars and all technology run into a slower lumbering merchant ship, much bigger merchant ship? It shouldn't happen. And it certainly shouldn't happen twice in the span of 2 months. Then you start to raise more serious, more fundamental questions about what might be going on in the Navy. So is it unique? You know, it's a good question. There's indications that what happened with John S. McCain was just a horrible accident and terrible timing and just bad luck. They lost steering, which obviously shouldn't happen. It's a very, in my experience as a sailor, I don't think it ever happened when I was underway. We drilled for it. We drilled for loss of steering every time we got underway, but I don't remember it actually happening ever. And I've talked to other sailors who say, "Oh, well, that doesn't happen all that often. It's not a normal thing to happen." And so John S. McCain looks like a fluke in a busy waterway. Fitzgerald looks like exactly like most of the investigations where these things happen, where, you know, a series of people losing the bubble and losing focus and possibly a poor command climate. But those are all things that are sort of to be reviewed or to come out of the review. So is it unique? You know, that's a question that I've gone back and forth with people about. I think it is. I think that what's going on is indicative of a larger problem, but I can't prove that until, you know, all the reviews and everything are done. And some people will tell you that it's just a series of bad luck. Accidents happen in three. Be interested in your guys' thoughts.
Yes, but when, you know, one point is an accident, you get two or three are, like we've seen, you know, four significant ones in the course of the year, you start to develop a trend line. And I had a similar reaction when I heard about the McCain, a few choice sailor words about the not again already. But another thing I did, not to wax your apple or anything, but if you're up on Twitter and you're not following David Larder on Twitter, you absolutely should, is I said, crap, David's an old destroyer guy. What's he coming up with? So I started stalking you a bit on Twitter. I've been following you for a while, but you and a few other people I was looking at because, you're a journalist, but you have a naval background. You're a former OS. And as somebody who that's your job, that's where you are at this point in your life, But as a pup, you are an OS. You're a destroyer, man, at heart. How does that background, do you think, help your reporting, but also perhaps be a distraction in your reporting? And how do you kind of separate that sailor part in you and those instincts and that thoughts vice the disciplined reporting that you want to do in your work?
So, you know, if you do follow me on Twitter, you'll probably see that there's that I have a tendency, and everybody that works with me on the other side of the phone or on the other side face-to-face in the Navy knows I can get spun up. And I hope by the time I file things that I've managed to temper some of my worst instincts. I've created a story that I think is balanced and represents everybody's views and that's well reported, and that I sort of stripping out some of my more emotional tendencies. But I tell you, this one it's an incisive question, because this one was very difficult. This series of accidents has been very difficult to cover for me, because it's emotional. It's hard to separate yourself when you slept below the waterline and you identify with those kids that are still out there doing that, and to understand that because of some confluence of events, and certainly the way it's trending with Fitzgerald, looks like they just lost focus, lost the bubble. I can't imagine feeling more betrayed than that, than, you know, my own shipmates losing the bubble to the point that, you know, some of my shipmates died and drowned in the racks. I can't comprehend that. So it's been difficult to separate out some of those emotional reactions with, you know, the duty to inform and the duty to get dispassionate information out there. And so where is it? That's where it hinders for me, is having that sort of background and really feeling that, you know, feeling that connection with those kids that are still out there on the water. Where it helps is certainly when the accidents happen, I knew exactly what they would have been doing. I knew exactly the actions they would be taking. I knew what to look for when, you know, the pictures of the Fitzgerald came out. And I know you remember it. You'll see all the hoses flaked out and pouring water out. I mean, you could just take a look at that, and you knew that there was some pretty significant – that was almost – it looked like every hose that they could possibly flake out was flaked out and was pumping water over the side. You knew that there was significant damage under the water line. You knew that there was a solid chance that some of those compartments were flooded completely. And, of course, we knew early on that the berthings were flooded. And, of course, you know, when it happens in the middle of the night, you assume the worst could be possible. So, yeah, where it helps is just knowing exactly what to look at and what, you know, what questions to ask. I think on a beat, really, when you really become proficient, as my colleague Chris Cavis was a supreme professional, because the reason he was so good is because he knew the questions to ask. He'd just been around and was curious and knew he knew his history, and he knew the history of the development of all the different ships that in the Navy, right back to, you know, the early 20th century. And so, you know, there are no new problems under the sun. They're just repeats. And so Chris knew the right questions to ask. And so in this case, I think probably just knowing the right questions to ask has given me an advantage over some of my peers, because they're still trying to figure out what damage control even means. And that's not a fault. It's just when you have a naval background, it's just you know what to ask for. So I hope I'm not rambling too much.
No, let me follow up on that though, because as a surface warfare officer myself, but an older one, I'm looking at this and going, you know, yeah, you got an OD and JOD and theoretically have lookouts and what in the world is combat doing? I look at these things and go, you know, there's got to be, you know, there's so many. At least when I was out there driving ships, there were so many checks and balances that, you know, it, not impossible, because we did it all the time. People run into each other, but we didn't do it all the time. But, you know, was your thinking, you know, as an OS, who was running the shop in CIC, or where did
absolutely.
You focus on this?
I mean, when we're talking about the larger question, so in the immediate aftermath of the of the accidents. My concern was always, and the questions I was asking were very much around, is the ship going to float? Have they stabilized the bulkheads? Are they in danger of losing? You know, one of the things that when I reported out on Samuel B. Roberts, I did a series of articles about the Samuel B. Roberts and sort of the fight to save that ship. And one of the things that Captain Wren told me is that you can only lose but so many main spaces before the ship is going to, you know, is going to founder. The Samuel B. Roberts had to save, I believe, Ox 2. And if a bulkhead had given, they would have probably gone to the bottom, or at least foundered. So, you know, those were the questions asked immediately. And to your question, that's a more long-term question. That's a, you know, I was telling my colleagues in the defense reporting world to just be very careful about how they're reporting this, because, you know, the OOD, if your source, if the source you were talking to was the OOD on Fitzgerald, he probably wouldn't be able to tell you how it happened, because if he knew how it had happened, it wouldn't have happened. To your point, yes. I mean, I wondered what the hell CIC was doing. Were the surface radar controller asleep at the console? And if the surface radar controller was asleep at the console, was the surface walk supervisor also asleep? And if he was asleep, was the surface warfare commander console, was that the guy that, you know, he's a first class OS or chief OS or chief fire controlman who talks to the strike group in strike group ops, the striker surface warfare commander. Was that guy asleep? And if that guy was asleep, was the TAO asleep as well? I mean, yeah, there's a lot of layers of overwatch in CIC to ensure that, you know, we're keeping a solid radar picture on the surface. I don't know what they were thinking. Did they see it and not listen to, and was the OOD not listening to CIC? I don't know. That's another question. What was the OOD even doing? The CO in the Fitzgerald was in his rack. That's unbelievable to me. If a ship was that close to my ship, my experience would be that the CO would be on the bridge. No matter, you know, the CO generally sleeps in his coverall because he needs to get up in the middle of the night and he doesn't want to run up there in his underage. So, yeah, I mean, all those questions. And I think that it's going to take a team of investigators to dig around on both ships to come up with some conclusions there as to what actually happened. It's baffling to me. I mean, your sense of confusion, I share it. I don't know how that happened. I know it has happened in the past, but I mean, the last one I remember was the Porter, major collision that I remember was the Porter, and that they were both trying to avoid each other at the last minute. And it sort of limited some of the damage because it was more of a glancing blow, if I remember correctly, and less of a direct, you know, T-bone. So, yeah, I don't know. It's those questions, I look forward to reading the investigation, and I think it would take a thorough investigation and a real deep dive to figure out what exactly happened, both just on that watch, and then what were the circumstances, what were the conditions in the context for why that watch just lost it. And, yeah, I don't know. Good question.
Yeah, like you, I'm looking forward to reading the report, and hopefully it'll be done as well as I think people are striving to do it. But we'll find out more details in the report on this particular, but all initial reports and what I've heard from, one thing that was really done well was the damage control afterwards, the behavior and the actions of the sailors getting out of the flooded spaces, keeping their ship afloat, getting everybody back into port was exemplary. And that all comes from being a well-drilled ship. You know, you don't come out of the womb knowing how to do damage control and how to evacuate spaces and keep your ship upright and back to port. That's only done through good training, good repetitive drills. But what seems to have really gone wrong here was everyday operations, communications. And I think you brought up a very good point that a lot of people outside the service may not be aware, is when you're underway, especially in contested waters, it's not one or two people up on the bridge that have an idea of what's going on around the ship. This is a multiple redundancy situation. And even if you do lose steering or lose a major sensor like your radar, you've got backups. You're trained to do that. And it's almost as if there's a series of things that should not have happened and things that could go wrong, And a lot of times the things that are bad happen, whether lives are lost or not, they all have to do that. We have similar press releases. Couple, three people get fired. It gets quiet. Somebody issues a report that collects dust, and you go forward and carry out the plan of the day. In your reporting on this, have you detected a sense perhaps this is being treated more seriously, that there's going to be a different set of actions you may see here, with the second correction and the third, the fourth, the series of the four actions so far this year, and we do have 17 sailors who have lost their lives due to what appears at first glance a failure of your day-to-day fundamentals. Do you feel that from the Navy, maybe this time we're going to take things a little more serious and we should expect to see some more come from this?
So I'd say the initial shot across the bow in that one was Admiral Swift flying out to Japan to personally relieve Vice Admiral Oldcoin. I don't know that it's ever happened. I've asked Jerry, and I don't think Jerry Hendricks, CNAS is preeminent naval historian, Center for New American Security, and he had said that he didn't know. It appears that it has never happened before, that they've fired another fleet commander, the 7th Fleet Commander, obviously based in Japan. I think more is coming. I think this is as serious, actually I would say even more serious than the Iran incident earlier last year, where the sailors were taken captive by Iranian forces. The Navy took that very seriously, and they fired a lot of people. And they, from my understanding, I need to delve into this, and this might be an interesting Midrash topic at some point. They've done some reorganization at NECC, Navy Expeditionary Combat Command, in the wake of that. And they've fundamentally started to rethink how they approach NECC. Now, I think that as a warfare unit inside the Navy, I think that surface warfare and certainly FDNF in Japan is going to look very different, and it's going to have different leadership. Not Admiral Sawyer, obviously, he just got there, but I think there's going to be different leadership probably at the Deseron level, probably at the strike group level, although I don't know that for sure. And I think that the Navy is going to take it seriously, and it may not stop there. It may go even further up the chain where these accountability actions happen. And I do get the sense that the Navy's taking this seriously. I get the sense that there's a lot of stars on the table as a result of this, if I'm reading this correctly. So it's going to look bad for a while. And I think what's going to result is a rethinking of how they do FDNF more narrowly and more broadly. I'd say there's going to be a rethinking of how we task surface ships. One of the downsides of being a surface sailor is there's less of a, I don't know if this is 100% fair, but I've always had the impression, having served on a surface ship and having, covered it now for the surface Navy now for a number of years, I get the impression that, with submarines, if there's something wrong with the nuke maintenance, or the plant's decertified, or there's an issue with that submarine, it's not going to get underway because NR wouldn't let it. Naval reactors wouldn't let it. If a pilot got a letter from his wife saying she wants a divorce, and as a result he could only sleep 4 hours before a mission, he's not going to take off the flight deck. I don't see the same kind of attitude generally reflected in the surface Navy. And I'm hoping, against hope, that maybe this is a wake-up call for the surface Navy to say, look, 8 hours of sleep is a good idea for a pilot before he takes off the flight deck. Maybe 8 hours of sleep is a good idea for the officer of the deck before they pull through the Strait of Malacca. Do I know that sleep is a factor? No, but I'm saying a general culture of safety, a general culture of we do not do this unless we've met these basic safety parameters, and that goes for certifications, that goes for crew rest, that goes for manning. Do we have all the – have we met fit fills, the number of sailors that we need to fit the exact billets or at least fill them adequately? And if we don't meet these basic parameters, then we don't operate. And we're going to have to tell COCOMs we're sorry. We can't meet that. We're going to have to tell the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff that BMD patrol that you want is not going to happen because – you know, the John S. McCain, once it's back up and running, hasn't met these parameters. So I don't know. I mean, I'm interested in what you guys think, too. I mean, am I off the rails here, or is this Eagle One, or does that sound does that sound like something that would be a good idea?
Yeah, you and I had a mini discussion about this on your Twitter thing,
yeah.
And I was going to bring that up. That it's my perception that And based on my experience, that it's very difficult for a CEO of a ship to say, I am not ready in all respects to go to sea. You always want to be, I think we used to call it C1, and Sally left, let me know if that still works. So you can go to sea on a ship with some major components not working right.
Right.
Because you can still float. You can still go through the water. But it doesn't mean that you're 100% when you're out there. You're hoping to get better if your crew is capable of doing the repair work to get rid of CAS reps and stuff. And what happens, in my perception, and I think this is still going on, is that you get this can-do attitude. You know, you never want to tell the boss, I can't do. And so you tend to assume, and this is a question about I would ask, is, you know, is the leadership and the responsibility and accountability, is it tied properly to the CEO who says, in all honesty, I've got an untrained crew, I don't feel safe taking these people to see what I've got, I can't fulfill this mission. You know, is he getting fired, or is he rewarded for telling the person? You said if pilots can't fly this air because there's some safety concern, I don't think that's a deal.
Dave, I know my co-host is kind of breaking up a little bit. Did you get enough of that question, or you want me to paraphrase?
No, I think I did. I think I agree with him to the effect that the you know, that is a problem in the Navy, and that there's an element of we want to be able to do everything we can. And to Moran's point from the testimony about the culture working against it, that is fair to an extent. I also wonder to the extent, and this gets into very sort of an intangible conversation, but I also wonder how much the will-do attitude gets involved. Eagle One is right. You know, surf warfare officers don't want to say to their boss, we can't get the ship underway. That there is a can-do and make-do sort of culture. And I think that's something that they're trying to get at with these reviews. But I also suspect that this probably goes to the reason why Alcoin was relieved. There also is probably a sense that that the person that makes that decision isn't necessarily the commanding officer. And I know that if Brian listens to this, he's going to lose his mind because he believes very strongly that he's a former destroyer skipper. And he believes very strongly that ultimately in the Navy, that the commanding officer, that command pin that you get is your shield against against all outside criticism of your command. And if you say to your commander that we will not do that, this is not safe, that obviously it's within the commander's right to fire him, but that it is his responsibility, it's incumbent upon the CEO to say no if something is unsafe. It's not a great career move all the time, but, you know, Brian would tell you that in his career he has made those calls and told his superior that he wasn't able to do it because he didn't feel it was safe and that he did not suffer any adverse career consequences. So to the extent that I believe that that's probably the case, and it's probably the case in well-functioning command climates, There is also the element of responsibility that the numbered fleet commander and the Deseron and the strike group commander also bears. And that is, they have to take the information that their COs are giving them and make a call. You know, if for example, in the case of the 7th Fleet ships, the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, pointed out that there was, I believe, more than 30% of them were operating with lapsed certifications, and they were lapsed and allowed to continue operating under what was called the Risk Assessment Management Plan, and that was signed off by Admiral Rodin at Naval Surface Force Pacific, among other places. Those are all bits of information that the numbered fleet commander has when he says, okay, well, you need to go do that mission. All commanders assume a certain amount of risk. And if the 7th Fleet commander says to the ship, you're going to get underway with X number of lapsed certifications, the ship isn't really in a great position to say no. Now, maybe it's the duty of the commanding officers to say no if they feel like there's too much risk. But, you know, to what extent is that responsibility diffused enough around your higher-ups that it's harder for you to actually say no? I don't know.
Yeah, I was having a few flashbacks when people were talking about readiness and CASREPs, because it really rang true. One of the great eye-openers I had as a young junior officer was having an O4 tell me to falsify, for lack of a better phrase, a readiness report. So we could report C2 vice C3, but knowing that I had the CO's back, because if he knew I was a bad liar, he wouldn't like if I did that without the thumbs up from him. So things were made very clear. No, report what it is. I'll deal with it from here. And as a recidivist staff weenie, I also saw what could happen on a flag staff when you go from a command climate that would chew people up for issuing CASREPs to having a flag officer begging his subordinate commanders to submit CASREPs because there were stuff being held back from previous atmospheres. And so from just a there's a personal background point of view, like most people have their own background that they get interested in. I will be reading that part closely because CASREPs are important regardless of what your code is, but ultimately it breaks down. Ships have a certain amount of equipment that's there for them to do their mission. People have training requirements for you to be able to do your mission and to safely execute your day-to-day operations. And if you can't even report whether that's what it should be accurately, then you don't know what your ship is. And all it takes is the wrong two events to take place, and lo and behold, bad stuff happens. But the one thing I wanted to talk to you about is when they were talking about the risk mitigation ramp. You know, it had me thinking about, you know, what we do at peace and what we do at war and how much risk we're actually assuming here. And we're not at war at sea, regardless of what people may think and how you want to define the terms. But we are at a certain type of quiet war in WestPac. And that has to do with the information operations, public affairs, PSYOPs arena with China. And those that are familiar with the world's great diversity and cultures, that is a face culture where you don't want to lose face. And it's been interesting to see some of the Asian press, again, some of it government controlled, like in China, who have been using this as a way to ping at us from a PSYOPs and information ops point of view. As a journalist, how do you see the press in WestPac, whether government-owned or not, and the agendas they may or may not hold, what type of impact our bouncing around in the seaways over there may be happening to us in a strategic context?
So in a strategic context, what impact are these having in terms of how the region perceives us in a strategic sense?
Exactly. How other nations perceive us, our competence, and have we kind of given our competitors a tool to use against us in a larger sense?
So China, Xinhua, the Chinese state news agency of my choice, that's the one I consume the most anyway, they jumped on it. They jumped on the opportunity to ask whether the U.S. Navy was a hazard operating in the Asia Pacific. And to some extent, as a former sailor and in my work, I try to be as objective as possible. But it's hard to detach yourself from your experience. That's somewhat demoralizing. It's like somebody bad mouthing your hometown or something of that nature. It's also really, I mean, again, I'm going to stray from subjectivity. It's also super disingenuous. It's super disingenuous for China to say that, because what's more hazardous, you know, some navigation errors or militarizing the South China Sea. But to the extent that the U.S. Navy gave them an opening by looking incompetent from time to time, I can't see why they wouldn't jump on the opportunity. And they have. They've raised this a number of times in Xinhua and certainly in the, I think it's called the Global Post. It's sort of their tabloidy version of Xinhua. And it's a separate publication, separate company, but sort of ties to the party as well. Yeah, they certainly have jumped on it. To what extent that has an effect, I don't know. I guess we'll see over the next few months if that has an effect. And there's certainly issues that need to be resolved in the long term, and there's certainly long-term strategic challenges that, you know, while the North Korea situation is what has everybody's attention, obviously the long challenge is going to be China. And do you think this has an effect? Do I think this has an effect on things like basing agreements with the Philippines? I don't know. To a certain extent, that's however they want to. The Philippines wants to take it. If they use this as an excuse to roll back some of the things that his predecessor did in terms of allowing greater access to Philippine facilities, or if some of the progress we've made in terms of our relationship with Vietnam and other countries in the region, if this causes them to rethink that, then to some extent I have to believe that that's an excuse rather than a valid reason. But that's no reason for the U.S. Navy or anybody to excuse giving China and their sort of larger agenda in the region the opportunity to pick at the Navy. Because what are you supposed to do if you're the U.S. Navy and you're trying to push back on that narrative? What are you supposed to do? They kind of have you dead to rights. They did screw up, and they have screwed up, and it's apparent to everybody. They spilled, the USS Antietam spilled a couple thousand, I think, gallons of oil in Tokyo Bay because they ran aground because they dragged anchor. The Lake Champlain, which is a third fleet ship chopped into Seventh Fleet, ran over a fishing boat, a Korean fishing boat. I thought about this one as well. The Japanese helped us for 3 days at great expense and great risk. You know, operating helicopters at sea is very dangerous, as everyone knows, to help look for one of our sailors who was hiding in the engine room. And now that was a somewhat kind of in the long term amusing set of circumstances. But it's also serious. How does that make us look to our allies in Japan? Does that make us look confident that we didn't look in the engine room for our guy? No. So, yeah, they got to straighten things out. So they've got to figure out how to operate professionally and reduce these very high-profile incidents, because I don't think it is making us look good. But I'm interested in your thoughts, honestly.
Well, let me shift the focus just a little bit. Jerry Hendricks has a piece out, as he frequently does, saying the United States Navy needs more ships. The more ships we have, the easier it would be for us to ride out the loss of a couple of, at least temporarily, loss of a couple of these major combatants. And tied to that very closely is the congressional inability to get a budget that makes sense. How much are those excuses for not performing professionally? Or are they contributing factors?
So Congress has a duty to pass a budget. And I don't think anybody, I don't think anybody would argue that they've somehow been responsible over the last, what, 8-9 years of increasing congressional impact. And yes, CRs do have an effect and a disproportionate effect on the surface Navy, because the surface Navy's maintenance is primarily run through overseas contingency operation funding, or OCO. And it's not a steady bill. It's nothing you can rely on. It's something of a congressional slush fund that ebbs and flows given on the demand signal and given on what, how, you know, negotiations go in conference. And sometimes the money doesn't show up on time. And sometimes that costs the Navy money. And sometimes that means they can't execute on a contract at time, in time. And so, yeah, Congress has not made the Navy's life easy. From my understanding, the Surface Navy will tell you that they've made inroads in terms of adjusting for that reality. But Congress is clearly deficient in what they've been sort of imposing on the Navy. I agree that in the long term, and this was Secretary Mavis's view of things, is that if you invest heavily in capacity and in the number of hulls that the Navy's operating, you then, in the long term, start to relieve some of the pressure on the surface fleet, primarily the surface fleet, and then obviously submarines as well. Although it's a much more shadowy area of the Navy, it's less well seen. But for me, and again, this is kind of where I'm married to my own experience, I have a hard time seeing much past the bulkheads, right? So when you're a sailor, a kid, essentially, 18-year-old kid, 19, 20-year-old kid, the Navy is the bulkheads of your ship. You know, the CNO may as well be a unicorn. No effect on your life that you see. what you know is your CO, and if the one star that is the or the one or two star that runs the CTF or the strike group comes on board, you know that you've been cleaning for 2 or 3 days because he seems like the most important person in the entire Navy. just because the admiral was coming on board, it's a big deal. I'm married to that experience, and for me, if the ship's broke and we can't get repair parts, that's the most important thing to me. We can't fix. So I heard an anecdote the other day about a ship that's Horizon System, which is a system that allows pilots to land on flight decks at night, and it's a vital part of the flight deck certification because it's essentially a horizon line that they can look at as a guide while they lower the helicopter onto the deck, which is, every time you do it, a dangerous operation. Well, apparently one of the ships, and I don't know what ship it is, but one of the ships is having an issue with a part for that, and that the part was made by a manufacturer that went out of business 10 years ago. It's very hard to find the part, and they don't have the money to replace the whole system. But it's still being made. They need to replace the whole thing. And so that's a ship, and I have no idea what phase of deployment it's in. I mean, maybe it could just be in the yards, and that's that has no real effect on operations. To the effect that that's demoralizing, that yes, that's their experience. So this is a long-winded way of saying that what's important to sailors is that their stuff works and that they're enabled to do their job. And so, yes, the budget uncertainties impact that, but I also have to believe that the people inside the Navy that are ordered to man, train, and equip the fleet, I wonder how much that's a priority when you get into the bean counter world, whether they're making priorities out of, modernization and certainly growing the capacity of the fleet. I think that all took a toll during Mavis's turn, where he was systematically sort of pushing money towards pushing money towards shipbuilding and in some cases diverting it away from maintenance and in some cases training. So yeah, I mean, that's a long-winded way of saying, yes, it would in the long term probably help the problem, but in the short term, it's making the problems that are, I think, becoming very evident to everyone out in 7th Fleet, at least, way worse, much worse. And I could be wrong. I mean, I think a lot of this becomes very subjective, and there could be different opinions on this show about that. But, yeah, that's my thought.
Yeah, I think there's definitely enough floating around in the air that's worthy of a good sniff. We only got about 5 minutes left before we have to let you check out of the daycare center and get on your airplane. But the one thing I wanted to run by you is the House Armed Services Committee this week had a hearing that advertised ahead of time that Vice Admiral Thomas Roden, everybody's favorite SWO boss, was going to be there. But a switch out was made, and the vice CNO, Admiral Moran, took his place instead at the hearing. As somebody who follows the military, also has a good finger feel for how the Navy works, what did that tell you when Vice Admiral Roden was pulled off and Admiral Moran was put in for that hearing? Does that inform you one way or another about the direction we may be taking here? Or was that just the vice CNO saying, I got it from here?
I think there's a little bit of everything in what you said. I think there is, because my information is that what O'Kane was ultimately fired for was assuming too much risk. And part of the risk were these ramp certifications that we know that is being taken seriously because it's something that Admiral Swift took on personally. And if a four-star says, ooh, I'm concerned about what's been going on here, I'm going to directly oversee this, which is TICOM business, by the way. Certifying a ship is ready for an underway or certified that they're prepared in various warfare areas. That's TICOM business, and now it's PAC Fleet business. Now they're saying that's temporary, but it's instructive about who's in the spotlight here. Now, my understanding and the explanation that I got, and I don't want to make too many assumptions one way or the other as to what it actually meant, is that, you know, that Moran is the XO of the Navy. He felt that they felt that he was in a better position to lend some authority at the hearing and show a bigger perspective. So yeah, I mean, it was, or at least, you know, offer a perspective above, you know, the 30,000 foot level, to use an airplane metaphor that I'm just about to board. I don't know. I guess the short answer is I don't know if it means more or the Navy certainly downplayed it as being significant. And you know what, if I am going to be delve into subjectivity here, Moran's really good at these things. He's very good. He's relatable. He has a way of diffusing tension. He has a way of looking serious and grave. And I thought one of the more remarkable moments in the hearing is when he said, I was operating under wrong assumptions about the readiness of 7th Fleet. I assumed that because they operate all the time, they're the most ready. And that assumption in hindsight was wrong. And I was wrong. I think that's a remarkable thing for a leader to say. And I don't think that's where it ends. I don't think he's saying, oh, I was wrong, excuses everything. Like, oh, yeah, he admitted he was wrong. And, you know, no more questions asked. I think you start asking more questions from there. And that's hopefully what I'll be doing in the weeks ahead. But about where those assumptions came from and how did he, was he asleep at the wheel or, you know, where did that come from? But all that to say, he did take on the mantle of responsibility there. And it was, perhaps it was a calculation that Roden wouldn't have been as skilled at taking the heat, than certainly Moran has proven time again on the Hill.
Yeah, I thought that was a key part of those hearings, and I want to. I don't really have time for another question. We got to let you get on that airplane, but I want to thank you for coming on, David, and we want to have you back again as soon as we can get you back on and discuss a lot more of these things at length. So again, thanks for coming on, and you better run to catch that plane before they close the door on you.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Gowan, and thanks, Sal. I really appreciate the opportunity to come on here.
Appreciate it as always. Have a safe flight and give our friend Jerry Hendricks a shout out for you in London. And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Mid Rats. Until next time, hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Hey, thanks, y'all.
Friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way.